I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books on winter. From soup to snowballs, we cover all things winter with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Jennifer Gaines, librarian at the Woods Hole Public Library. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, Jill, kick us off with this book that you really had to dig deep back into the shelves to find.
I did. In fact, I had to dig so deep, I had to go to my own bookshelves because there is not a copy on Cape Cod, in Cape Cod libraries, as far as I can tell. Although, after I finish talking about this, I will give you a clue as to how you can find your own copy of this. And this is a collection of essays by a fellow named J.B. Priestley. The title seems like not the most likely title for a show about winter. It's called Apes and Angels by J.B. Priestley, who was an English novelist, a playwright, essayist. He wrote over 100 novels, plays, essays, and now probably nobody knows who he is. I mean, it's one of those moments where you think all these people who want to be, you know, write a book and everyone. I mean, this guy wrote hundreds of things and
How long ago?
Well, this particular volume, funny you should ask, this particular volume was published in 1928.
Okay.
So, you know, a while ago. In any case, within this volume of essays, there is one which is called First Snow, and it includes some of my favorite lines about snow ever, and I'm just going to share a little bit of this because it's just so beautifully written, and it gives you that feeling that you get with the first snow. This is how it goes. The first fall of snow is not only an event, but it is a magical event. You go to bed in one kind of world and wake up to find yourself in another, quite different. And if this is not enchantment, then where is it to be found? The very stealth, the eerie quietness of the thing makes it more magical. If all the snow fell at once in one shattering crash, awakening us in the middle of the night, the event would be robbed of its wonder. But it flutters down, soundlessly, hour after hour, while we are asleep. And it goes on
I
to
love
tell
that.
You, it's so, that idea that it is this magical event because the world is so transformed when the snow falls.
It's true.
It's
and I
lovely.
Love that quiet. We also have the wind blowing kind of snow, but that's not the snow we're talking about here.
And what I will tell you about, the secret about finding this book or this essay is it is actually included in something called Essays of Five Decades. The fellow wrote for a long time. And if you do not know the Commonwealth Catalog, which is available to anybody with a Clam's library card, well, actually available to anybody in the state with a library card, you can actually request this from off Cape, even though there is not a copy here on Cape Cod. So the Commonwealth Catalog is your tip for the day.
All right. Thank you. Jennifer, what's your first book?
So I have a quote from Edith Wharton, another novelist from a long period of time and a long time ago. I think that Ethan Frome was written just a little bit earlier than that Priestley book, and we all remember it from high school required reading, but the very first paragraph just sets the scene. The village lay under 2 feet of snow, with drifts at the windy corners. In a sky of iron, the points of the Dipper hung like icicles, and Orion flashed his cold fires. The moon had set, but the night was so transparent that the white house fronts between the elms looked gray against the snow. Clumps of bushes made black stains on it, and the basement windows of the church sent shafts of yellow light far across the endless undulations.
Mm.
Sounds cold, hey?
Yeah. There's the cold snow, and then there is the warm. There is the snow that you go out where it doesn't really feel cold, and it is sort of magical, and you watch it fall. I like that snow better than the warm snow. I have to say, I used to be really excited for that first snow when I lived in Vermont because you're close to the ski areas. I don't get as excited on the Cape with the first snow, I have to admit.
Well, I have to say, I also brought a book called Midsummer Snowballs, and this is an extraordinary thing. This is about an art installation that Andy Goldsworthy did in London. And as somebody who always tries to save at least one snowball in the middle of the winter and put it in the freezer.
You do?
I do.
Oh my God.
So that when July hits, you've got one snowball in the freezer and you can appreciate it in a way you never can.
Although it's an ice ball
February.
By July.
Well, yes, but
don't throw that at anybody.
No. But still, it has, you know, it is actual. It was actual snow, even though, yes, it does get a little bit icy.
I might do that this year. I might do that.
It's a great thing. Yeah. People get very
excited.
Put it
out by the pool in
yeah,
July.
Exactly. Right. Well, and that was Andy Goldsworthy's idea. And this book is about what he did on June 21st, 2000, between midnight and dawn. He took 13 huge snowballs and placed them in the middle of London. And inside, he had been creating these for like years. I mean, he's an artist. He does a lot of installations outside. And what he had been doing was creating these snowballs for years. He put inside these snowballs elderberries and ears of barley and wool and crow feathers, beech branches, chalk, river pebbles, and metal, so that as they melted, all these other things were being revealed. Mm. So it was both the idea of what it would be like for people to find these snowballs in June, and also how they transformed themselves into other kinds of art as they melted. And he talks about snow in this book, and he says, snow provokes responses that reach right back to childhood. A snowball is simple, direct, and familiar to most of us. I use this simplicity as a container for feelings and ideas that function on many levels. Even in winter, each snowfall is a shock, unpredictable and unexpected. Occasionally, I've come across a last patch of snow on top of a mountain in late May or June. There's something very powerful about finding snow in summer. It's as if the whole of winter has drained through that white hole, a concentration of winter. Mm. So it's full of photographs of people's reactions to these snowballs in the middle of London. And it's really quite fascinating. And of course, kids love them. You can see how much kids are having with them, other people. And he's documenting this as he goes. So he's writing about how people are reacting to his art and how people are, in some cases, destroying his art, depending on what their opinion of his art is. So it's really actually a fascinating book about snow and art, and it's called Midsummer Snowballs by Andy Goldsworthy.
All right. Jennifer, what's your next book?
I think, therefore, we have to move right on to Bentley, Snowflake Bentley, whose books Jill and I both brought. There's one by Mary Azarian, whose art I really, really like, woodcut. Mr. Bentley was the first person to photograph snowflakes. And between the two of us, we have three books about Bentley. And one of them is a Dover print that is the actual photographs of his snowflakes. It goes page after page after page of beautiful, beautiful snowflakes. And the two books, Jill has a biography for adults, which I couldn't find on my shelf because she'd already requested it. And then we both have from our kids' collection this children's book, which is just beautiful. And talk about devotion to snowflakes. It was a very hard time he had, hard, poor time he had living in his Vermont farm and trying to collect the snowflakes. And I had some great sympathy for the collecting part because I always go out and collect snowflakes every year. And boy, they sure don't last long.
Yeah. The artwork in that children's book is beautiful.
Yes, that's Mary Azarian.
Yeah,
she's just fantastic.
Yeah.
She does beautiful, beautiful work. And in that book, you learn about how his parent, he decides, I mean, he's sort of a curious kid, right?
Yeah.
He's really interested in trying to film these, catch these. And he starts by trying to draw the snowflakes, but he can't because they melt too fast. Mm-hmm. And so his parents end up actually selling a cow or something and buying him a camera with which he can do.
As a kid he did this.
As a kid he started this.
Starting at age 15, he drew 100 snow crystals each winter for 3 winters.
Wow.
Okay. So
and then, of course,
18.
It does have a sort of sad ending. Well, and at the end, there's a blizzard, and he gets pneumonia and ends up, but, you know, sort of fitting. And
he
then the kids of Vermont.
When he could succeed in this,
The kids of Vermont decide many years later to build a monument, right?
Yeah. So
it's a beautiful book. And what I did not know until I grabbed The Snowflake Man, a biography of Wilson A. Bentley from the Woodsow Library,
before Jennifer got it,
which is written by Duncan C. Blanchard, is that there is a hooey connection in this book. In fact, the author of this book, Duncan G. Blanchard, writes in his prologue that nearly 20 years later, he had known about Bentley, and he says nearly 20 years later, as an atmospheric scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and very familiar with the frontiers of research on rain formation, I knew that Bentley was an American pioneer in the science now known as cloud physics, and that his work was about 40 years ahead of its time. I also had seen and was enthralled by the exquisite beauty of the thousands of photographs in his great book, Snow Crystals, his life's work, published the year of his death. I had learned that by the 1920s, Bentley, at the height of his fame, was known to tens of thousands across the country simply as the Snowflake Man. Mm. And that phrase that you hear all the time, no two snowflakes are the same, apparently came from Wilson Bentley.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, no. All right. What have you got up next, Jennifer?
Let's see. I thought we should touch on classic fiction.
Sure.
So I, of course, thought of Kawabata's Snow Country, which is set mostly in western Japan on the other side of the mountains, where it's much, much snowier. Turns out that Kawabata did indeed win the Nobel Prize, in part for this book, which is written in the 20s, and of all the rest of his work also. And as I was struggling my way through it, it reminded me of a Japanese friend of mine telling me, I think we Japanese like sadness more than you Americans. Or maybe it was depression. I'm not sure which. Anyway, if you want snow, you could read that one.
All right. What's the other one that you said you had a
couple? The other one I have that's a classic, in quotes, is Orhan Pamuk, Other Side of the World. It's called Snow. It's from Turkey. And he also won the Nobel Prize. His are much more political than Kawabata's, which... So it touches on not only the snow and the young man who's in it, but also the political conditions in Turkey at the time. Good read.
Okay.
And as long as we're talking about novels, a novel that we both brought, which again does not happen all that often. It must be because we've got two librarians on the show this morning, which is Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Long Winter, which is a classic of its own. And it's a tale of this family who's near starvation. The town is crippled because there is no food when blizzards keep the supply train from reaching the settlers. And it's set in 1881. It's based on her life. And here's just a little clip, and it will make you so cold reading this novel, so cold that you will be so delighted to know that they don't all die at the end of this book, which you would expect them to do as you're reading this novel. Here's a little snippet. The sun was setting so red that it colored the frosted window panes. It gave a faintly rosy light to the kitchen where they all sat undressing and singing by the warm stove. But Laura thought there was a change in the sound of the wind, a wild and frightening note. After Ma had seen them all tucked in bed and had gone downstairs, they heard and felt the blizzard strike the house. Huddled close together and shivering under the covers, they listened to it. Laura thought of the lost and lonely houses, each one alone and blind and cowering in the fury of the storm. There were houses in town, but not even a light from one of them could reach another. And the town was all alone on the frozen, endless prairie, where snow drifted and winds howled, and the whirling blizzard put out the stars and the sun. Laura tried to think of the good brown smell and taste of the beef for dinner tomorrow, but she could not forget that now the houses and the town would be all alone till spring. There was half a bushel of wheat that they could grind to make flour, and there were the few potatoes, but nothing more to eat until the train came. The wheat and the potatoes were not enough.
Mm.
Right. And it's a grim tale until spring finally comes.
So you may not want to read that one in the winter.
Or it might on a hot
feel
summer
much
day, right?
About your winter. But Jill and I both also brought Pioneer Girl, which is an annotated autobiography of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And it talks indeed about that blizzard and has some nice archival photographs, which of course I like, of some people who look very grim, some not so grim, and little things like twists of hay that they used to burn.
Oh.
And that was about all they had for fire, except perhaps cow plops.
Wow.
And they also, it has great photos of the train stuck in the snow, which are chilling to see how much snow they were. It takes to stop a train, which is lots and lots.
Who doesn't like archival photos, by the way? Right? No, I mean seriously. Yeah. They're always. They give you such a great glimpse into
the past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. I think we're going to need some soup after this. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on winter with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Jennifer Gaines, librarian at the Woods Hole Public Library. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have a thought for a good winter book to put on our list. 866-999-4626, or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, we're getting a little bit cold here, so we're going to warm up with some soup before we go back to the winter. Jennifer, what's the soup book you have?
Well, strangely, Jill and I both also brought books about soup. And I had a whole stack of books about soup. I said, this is ridiculous. I can't carry all these books.
We're not lists here. We have the actual books on the table. Yeah.
It's quite nice. We're all very cozy with our books. The one that I brought has a vineyard it's from the vineyard, Martha's Vineyard. And it's written by Catherine Walters, photography by Allison Shaw. And it's called Soups and Sides. And it looks just yummy. I have to admit to not yet trying it out, but as winter draws in, I think I'll be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Allison Shaw's photography is always fabulous. Yes. Yeah. What do you
and
have, Jill?
What I brought along is yet another connection to the books we were just talking about, the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, because this cookbook is called Roast Fig, Sugar Snow, Winter Food to Warm the Soul.
Oh, I love that title.
Isn't it? You're feeling warmer already, ooh, right? And here, right at the front of her book, she has a quote from Laura Ingalls Wilder. In the morning, the house was warm from the stove, but when Laura looked out of the window, she saw that the ground was covered with soft, thick snow. All along the branches of the trees, the snow was piled like feathers, and it lay in mounds along the top of the rail fence and stood up in great white balls on top of the gateposts. Pa came in shaking the soft snow from his shoulders and stamping it from his boots. It's a sugar snow, he said, which is from The Little House in the Big Woods by Laura Ingalls Wilder. And it is, in fact, the whole last section of this book is about sugar snow, which is maple syrup. Mm. That apparently is what it was called. And the book itself, her cookbook, was inspired by her childhood reading, which I think is also very inspirational to me in a cookbook. It's not many cookbooks that are, start out. But in fact, those Little House books, I mean, there's a Little House cookbook. They're filled with food, in fact, even though in the one we were talking about, everybody's starving. Focus is really on food. And there also is a great section in Roast Figs, Sugar Snow on cranberries and blackberries from bush and bog. As it says, it is a freezing October in Massachusetts. And everywhere I look, there are scarlet lakes surrounded by trees glowing with autumnal foliage. The beauty of cranberries, Christmas red and smooth as beads, ebbing and flowing in blue flooded bogs is mesmerizing. So if you want some cranberry recipes, this is a good book. You also, lots of things about bread, apple bread and rib chops, things that are going to keep you warm all winter. And it is a beautiful book, by the way, and it's called Roast Figs, Sugar Snow.
Is that the only cookbooks we have?
Oh, no. We do have some other cookbooks as well. And one of them is by one of my favorite writers, Laurie Colwyn, who, alas, is no longer with us. But she wrote a couple of cookbooks, and they are so wonderful. And part of the great things about her cookbook, one of the great things about her cookbooks are they are just as much. If you never cook, you'll still enjoy reading one of her cookbooks because they're so full of humor and warmth and great writing. This one is More Home Cooking, A Writer Returns to the Kitchen by Laurie Colwyn. You'll find a recipe for hot lemonade. You'll find some great recipes for lentil soup. And she talks about soup. She says, but it is soup that concerns us here for a number of reasons. It is warming, comforting, good for you, and most important, it is easy. It is thrillingly easy, and it has a quality loved by all pressed cooks. It does the work for you, which is my kind of cooking. I think that was great. And she also has a great section on how to face the holidays, which begins, When Thanksgiving has passed and the leaves are off the trees, the harried modern person looks to the winter holidays like someone slumped across a railroad track contemplating an oncoming train. No matter what persuasion you may be, the idea of Hanukkah or Christmas with New Year's Eve to follow is enough to fill the most cheerful heart with dread. Shopping, wrapping, hiding presents, going to the post office, and standing online forever trying to get a taxi in the freezing cold to bring home the ingredients for a festive meal, and so forth. The older I get, the more I shrink from the frenzy and hype and the potlatch aspect of present giving. I yearn for some simpler time when people gave each other jars of homemade jam and hand-knitted mittens. Mm. And she goes on to give you a couple of recipes that are quite complicated, but that you can do ahead. So, but you do need to start at the beginning of December, because there's both a country Christmas cake, which has a very long list of ingredients, and also a beef dish. So this is
warm lemonade. What was it? Hot lemonade?
And hot lemonade.
Have you ever had that?
Oh, absolutely.
It's one of
my mother used to give me when I was sick. When you had a sore throat, you got hot lemonade. And as she says here, and when you have run out of things to cook with lemons, you can use them as medicine. When you or a loved one is sick with the flu, a very good remedy is hot lemonade. And, you know, basically it's hot lemonade. Although in her case, she's adding a cinnamon stick and some honey. More Home Cooking by Lori Colwin is the name of the book.
All right. So are we done with cookbooks?
I have just one more, which is Homemade Winter by Yvette Van Boven. And it's also got a wonderful... cookbooks have really changed, may I just say. So many cookbooks now are just beautiful photographs of the food. I'm assuming the recipes are good as well.
Yes.
But, you know, you can't really tell. And in this one, she actually draws some of her recipes, which I think are great. So this one, she's got frittata of kale and bacon. And it's literally little illustrations of how you cook this frittata. And it looks so simple. Looking at these illustrations, I feel that even I, who actually did have a mother who was a home economics teacher, which may have been, you know, my fear of cooking, but that she has written a beautiful book called Homemade Winter, Yvette Van Boven, with beautiful photographs.
Okay, I was going to say, yeah, the photograph is not of the food. It's of the countryside.
That's right.
Yeah. It's British.
It's the feel of the food.
Did she do Homemade Summer?
Yes,
also?
She did.
Yes, that was one I was looking for. Some patron came in and renewed it instead of bringing it back. So she said it was beautiful and wonderful. And there it is.
Yeah. All right, Jennifer, what have you got next on your list?
I have fiction that needs winter, that uses winter. And I brought this one for you.
For me? Okay.
Yes, you, Mindy. Because it is the reason that I ever learned about Old Squaw Ducks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is old fiction, not particularly classic, but one that I appreciate because of that very reason. One, I had just read it about Thanksgiving time about 35 years ago, and we were sailing our leaky wooden Harrishaw from Quisset to Woods Hole through the cold, cold air, and I heard this strange noise coming across the water, kind of a warbling, gobbling, squeaking, creepy noise. And I said, oh, that's the Old Squaw Ducks, which are now, of course, not called Old Squaw. They're more, what are they? Long-tailed
duck.
The book is called The White Shaman by C.W. Nickel, and it's about a young man who went to the Arctic and lived with the Inuit. And he started out as a field assistant to a biologist, and he became so entranced with the life there that he stayed.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And those long-tailed ducks are amazing, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. If you get a chance to see them, you should check it out.
Clouds of hundreds of them on the surface.
Hundreds and thousands. Yeah. It's just like smoke in the sky. Although the last couple of years, it hasn't been quite those numbers.
And sometimes they're even right here in Woods Hole.
Yeah.
And you can see them from the ferry.
But if you're on Nantucket, that's really where you get a good show. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Sorry, moving on. Thank you, Jennifer, for bringing that in.
And I have brought another poem. And this poem, for those of you, you know, that may not be interest in cookbooks. This is another way to that one person is interested in spending winter. This is it's not so much a poem as it is. It's sort of a prose poem. It's sort of an essay. And it is called Snow by Mary Ruffel. It is in a collection of her poems and essays called The Most of It, which, may I say, only the Vineyard Haven Library has a copy of. So I would like to commend the Vineyard Haven Library for having a copy of this. Falmouth, I promise, will soon have a copy of this because I love this piece so much. It is called Snow by Mary Ruffel. I'll just read a little bit of it. It's another way to spend your winter. Every time it starts to snow, I would like to have sex. No matter if it is snowing lightly and unseriously or snowing very seriously well on into the night, I would like to stop whatever manifestation of life I am engaged in and have sex with the same person who also sees the snow and heeds it, who might have to leave an office or a meeting or some arduous physical task or conceivably leave off having sex with another person and going the snow to me, who is already in the snow, beginning to have sex in my snow mind, someone for whom, like me, this is an ultimatum, the snow sign, an ultimatum of joy, though as an ultimatum beyond joy as well as sorrow. I would like to be in the classroom, for I am a teacher, and closing my book, stand up, saying, it is snowing and I must go have sex, goodbye, and walk out of the room, and starting my car in the beginning stages of snow, know that he is starting his car with the flakes falling on its windshield, or if he is at home, he is looking at the snow and knowing I will arrive, snowy, in 10 or 20 or 30 minutes, and if the snow has stopped off, we as humans can make a decision, but not while it is still snowing, and even half snow would be something to be obeyed. I often wonder where the birds go in a snowstorm, for they disappear completely. And she goes from here into this whole meditation on birds and what's happening with the birds. And from there, she goes into the snow on graves and what that's like, and then sort of circles back to her premise where she likes to have sex with the snow. It's just the most beautifully fun, silly, and romantic sort of essay on snow. And that's by Mary Ruffel, and it is called Snow. And you will find it, you can, of course, find it online, but you can also find it in her book, The Most of It.
All right. How do you follow that, Jennifer?
Well, I was thinking, as you were reading and reading about sex in the snow, I thought, oh, she must be part owl, because that's when owls meet. January,
see,
February.
See, now, Jennifer, this is the sort of thing you know that I would not
Yeah, we've stood out on moonlit nights when the ground is covered with snow and heard the owls echoing back and forth to each other. It's just so magical.
I love
magical.
That, yeah, it really is.
Just magnificent.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so your next book, Jennifer?
Well, I think I'm going to have to go to this pile because I enjoy winter for many things, but one of them is being able to track the animals.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
On the owl theme, my greatest sighting last winter, or not sighting, or follow-up sighting, was walking down first thing in the morning and seeing some mouse tracks hopping across the lane, as they do with their little 4 feet hitting one spot and then a big space in the next 4 feet, and sometimes the tail shows. And all of a sudden they're interrupted, but I could see the tracks of wings in the soft snow on both sides as an owl snatched that mouse and flew away.
And there you go. Tracks in the Snow told you that whole story.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So of course, everyone should have some sort of tracking book at the ready. There's the classic Olus Murie, the Peterson Field Guide to Animal Tracks. And that's everyone should have it. And then there are a lot more that have come out. And as Jill said about the cookbooks, a lot of the new ones have more photographs in them and are more beautiful books than just tomes. This one called Tracking and the Art of Seeing by Paul Resendiz is wonderful. It goes animal by animal, has photographs of their tracks, photographs of the animals, photographs of the scat, sketches of the animal walking, running, jumping, playing. It's just wonderful. And I do love tracking.
You know, it's sort of fun, too, when you have a book that can tell you what, you know, especially when you have kids or grandkids and you're seeing like, okay, what is that, a dog print? Is it a coyote? Is it, you know, a rabbit? It's really sort of fun.
Yes, and he has diagrams of dog and coyote and bobcat tracks all on the same page with diagrams to show you exactly what the difference is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the great thing about snow is you can see a lot of tracks you can't normally see.
That you didn't know the animal was there. No, it's left its trail. On the same theme, there's Bernd Heinrich, who's quite a prolific author. But my favorite of his books is called Winter World. And it's about the mostly the animals, but also about the plants in winter. And he is indeed a scientist, and some of his science involves, unfortunately, stripping the wool off some animal and seeing how quickly it loses its heat and things like that. So that's a little upsetting, but in general, it's very interesting. And it's illustrated with some sketches of his own. And it was his book that told me about the golden-crowned kinglets that... In the wintertime, they're so tiny. They're tiny. They make chickadees look like big lugs.
Really?
They're teeny tiny, sweet little things. And he said he'd seen them cuddled up next to each other on a branch, four or five of them, just side by side, so that they weren't losing heat on their sides. They were next to another one. So his books are just full of bits of information like that. I do enjoy them. Of course, I've never sat down and read the whole thing because it's a thing you pick up and read sections about.
All right. Jill.
Well, I wanted to mention that before we did this show, I was asking the staff at the library what they might read during the winter to get an idea of what people do read in the winter. Do you read differently in the winter? You know, we always talk about summer reading. Is winter reading different from summer reading? So here are a couple of the responses I got, which I think are really great. And if you have specific things you read in the winter, give us a call.
Yes, for sure.
Here we go. Here's one. She says, it all started with Little Women because of the opening line, but I always read a big, juicy classic that I can totally get caught up in on a slow, cold Sunday afternoon. The couch, a fire, a cup of tea, the smell of Sunday dinner in the oven, and good writing that endures the test of time and memory. So that is one way people approach winter reading. And here is another one. One winter, a few years back, I wanted some Southwest warmth, so I went through a couple of Tony Hillerman novels. Usually I do look for real heat when it's chilly outside. This year, though, I need some comfort books to help me with the bleakness we all might be facing for a while. Currently reading The Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Douglas Abrams. It's good hearing their reassuring words. On my list, I also have some books with the word magic in the title. How do you spell escapism? So there's another approach to your winter reading. Read books that are set in hot climates.
Right, or garden books. I love in the middle of winter when everything's all covered in snow to open some pretty garden pictures. Makes you start thinking about, you know, spring.
And I actually brought a garden book with me. Okay, as a matter of fact, I brought one garden book, although you'll laugh when you see why I brought this particular garden book. This is called A Gardens of Awe and Folly, A Traveler's Journey on the Meaning of Life and Gardening by Vivian Swift. If you've never seen one of her books, they are beautiful. They are filled with her beautiful illustrations, and they're sort of meditations on life as this one. In this case, she's following beautiful gardens and visiting beautiful gardens, but one of the chapters is based on Edinburgh, her time in Edinburgh, and it says, Moments of Truth in a Winter Garden. And she talks about Scotland, and she says Scotland is more than the land of introverts. It is also the land for introverts. I love being in my favorite foreign city when the days are half lit and glazed by a cold winter rain. I am a connoisseur of rain, all us introverts are, and January rain in Edinburgh is the rain of romance. It's for those of us who love the quiet of libraries, the minor third of a sad song, and the aloneness of a 4 o'clock twilight. If you happen to be a person who does not enjoy your own company, a visit to Edinburgh in January will teach how it's done. And then she visits Dunbar's Close Garden, the only Baroque garden, apparently, laid out in the character of 17th century Edinburgh. And she talks a little bit about what it is to see a tree in winter, which is so different from seeing a tree at any other time. She says, to see a tree in winter is to see it for what it really is. A winter tree is an object so intricate and so perplexing that if it hadn't already been decided that winter trees were plain and boring, we would be spending hours pondering them, staring at them in astonishment. So do take a look at this book. It will make you feel better because her pictures are so beautiful. And she does, of course, have many gardens that are happening in the summer. So you can look at all those summer flowers and all those summer green, but also give a little meditation to what trees look like, particularly in winter.
866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on winter with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Jennifer Gaines, librarian at Woods Hole Public Library. 866-999-4626 if you have a suggestion for our list. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're going to stick with the tree theme, Jennifer.
Okay. Another book that I brought in is Don Stokes's Guide to Nature in Winter, Northeast and North Central North America. And it has the most wonderful little pen and ink sketches. And it has a big section on trees. And it always has a silhouette of the whole tree and then a piece of the branch with the budding and the maybe the fruits. And it's just magnificent. I've had this by my side for a long, many long winters. I just find it so useful.
It's interesting, you know, just I'm going to mention Beth Schwartzman's book, The Nature of Cape Cod, which, again, it's the stuff you think you go these trails or these hiking things in the summer or the fall, and then you take them in the winter and they look completely different, right? I was hiking in New Hampshire with a friend, and this is a place she grew up now and doesn't really go in the winter in the snow. We were snowshoeing on the trails that she actually, and we were lost because she was like, this doesn't look the same at all. So having some of those books to help you identify what some of these trees are is
a new book that came out is called Bark: A Field Guide to Trees of the Northeast by Michael Wojcik. And although the photographs are not usually in winter, they are just the trunk of the tree. And then there's some pieces of branch, too, so you can find out if the leaves are alternate or opposite or whatever. And it also is wonderful because it has a little coin for scale, which is interesting because when they have all these great gashes or parts of the tree, it's good to know how big they are, which you can't always tell.
Yeah. It's tough to tell a tree by its bark, I think.
Oh, it's a wonderful accomplishment.
Yeah.
The reason I got the Stokes out a few years ago is that there was something I thought might be a hop hornbeam. And by the time I was done with him, I said, yes, it is.
Oh, well.
Yeah. So that's, yes. Very so fun. All these nice tips.
Okay. Great. Jill.
Well, the first book I actually thought about when I thought about the show was the book I'm about to talk about, which is Winter, Five Windows on the Season by Adam Gopnik. Many of you probably know Adam Gopnik. He's a longtime contributor to The New Yorker. And as it happens, he was born in Philadelphia but raised in Montreal. And you will never find anyone who loves snow, I think, as much as Adam Gopnik loves snow. And this was originally lectures that were done. So it reads a little oddly in that it was originally lectures. However, as one reviewer described it, it's part lyrical love letter to winter, part rigorous cultural history of the season's image in the popular imagination. It covers everything that you can imagine. It covers music, art, storytelling, engineers, architects, polar explorers. And after you're done with this, you will have so many more reading opportunities because he has this huge bibliography at all the things he looked at. It makes you think about the Impressionists and how they painted snow, and you want to then go look at all books having to do with snow and the Impressionists. He writes at the beginning of this about his memories of snow. He says, and winter, my memories are of a rare feeling of perfect equanimity, standing on top of Mount Royal in the middle of Montreal on cross-country skis at 5 o'clock on a February evening, and feeling a kind of peace, an attachment to the world, an understanding of the world that I'd never had before. This emotion has never left me. My heart jumps when I hear a storm predicted. Even in the perpetual grisaille of Paris, my smile rises when cold weather is promised, even in forever 40-something Fahrenheit New York. Gray skies and December lights are my my idea of secret joy, and if there were a heaven, I would expect it to have a lowering violet-gray sky and white lights on all the trees and the first flakes just falling, and it would always be December 19th, the best day of the year, school out, stores open late, Christmas a week away. And he takes these five windows, sort of looking at how to look at winter. And so he's got a section on romantic winter. He has a section on radical winter, recuperative winter. You will learn more about ice hockey than you probably need to know if you don't play.
I was going to ask about hockey, being from Montreal.
And actually, this was the book that introduced me to Wilson Snowflake Bentley, because he is in here. You will then want to read about polar expeditions. I mean, honestly, you could read this one book, Adam Gopnik, Winter, Five Windows on the Season, and you would have enough reading to get you through to June.
Now, in his romantic section, does he talk about a full moon, like, you know, cross-country skiing or sleigh ride or anything in a full moon on a nice winter night? It's beautiful.
It is gorgeous. The snow
Yeah.
And the quiet you sometimes get when you're out at night in the snow and the full moon.
Yeah,
and
beautiful.
So spectacularly beautiful.
All right. Jennifer, what's next on your list?
Well, that reminds me, I don't know if you want to get into the children's books.
Sure,
yet.
Yeah. Owl Moon. Oh, yes. I like that.
Owl Moon by Jane Yolen. And the illustrations are by John Schoner. And they're just exquisite. It's about a little kiddo who went out walking with her father. It looks like it's Pennsylvania, out into the winter snow, up the hill, through the woods. And you can see the shadows of the moonlight. And they're calling owls and listening for the owls to call back. And it's just a most wonderful expression of winter and also the bonding between the father and child. The illustrations themselves
are beautiful.
Just wonderful.
Boy, there you go. Full moon. Yeah.
Full
look
moon,
at that.
Great horned owl.
Ooh.
Yeah.
All right. A listener recommends that we listen to a song called Snowfall by Claude Thornhill from the 1940s while looking at some of these pictures. So thank you for that suggestion. I'm not familiar with the song. We'll have to look it up. Okay.
And I have a children's book, which is a little hard to describe because it works two ways. If you read it one direction, it's the story of Inkdrop and Snowflake. And it starts with the story saying, all snowflakes have a long journey to make before tumbling down from the clouds, but there was one snowflake that had been traveling for a particularly long time. And it is the story of this one snowflake. However, if you turn the book around, you then get the story of the ink drop, which begins, a lively wind was whisking up the dry leaves in the lane. It lifted them higher and higher, right up to the window of an artist's studio. It rattled the windows, blowing in through the cracks. The artist had gone out for a hot loaf of bread, so the only thing stirring was a drop of ink sighing inside her bottle. For days, she had been waiting for the artist to carry her into one of his wonderful drawings. And so you follow the story of the ink drop, you follow the story of the snowflake, and in the middle of this book, literally in the middle of this book, the two meet outdoors because the ink drop happens to go flying out the window and the snowflake is coming down from the sky. And it's hard to describe how beautiful this book is, but the illustrations are beautiful. The format of it is beautiful. And
that's very clever.
At the very middle of it, there is a huge spread where they do, in fact, meet. And they are then one, as it were. And there are snowflakes that are sort of cut into the paper as well. It's a four-page spread in the center, and both stories end with the same last line. They had endless stories to tell each other. Their embrace lasted forever. And part of what you see is you see the snowflakes coming down from the sky. You see the artist coming out of the store with his bread, who you've heard about from the ink drop. And so you wouldn't imagine that a snowflake and an ink drop would necessarily come together. But in this spectacularly beautiful children's book, the story of Snowflake and Ink Drop by Alessandro Gatti is just, it's a beautiful story. And the illustrations are by Simona Mulanzani and translated from the Italian by Brenda Porster. Beautiful book.
All right. You have another children's book?
I do. It's one of my favorite children's books. It's about a brave little girl named Irene.
Which is one of my favorite children's books, too.
She's a great role model. Brave Irene by William Steig. And it's about a little girl whose mother was a seamstress. And her mother finished the ball gown for the Duchess. But then her mother got sick. And the little girl had to carry the package with the dress in it all across the hills, over the snow, to the Duchess's home for the ball. And the snow got higher and higher. It really was cold outside, very cold. The wind whirled the falling snowflakes about this way, that way, into Irene's squinting face. She set out on the uphill path to Father Bennett's sheep pasture. By the time she got there, the snow was up to her ankles, and the wind was worse. It hurried her along and made her stumble. Irene resented this. The box was problem enough. "Easy does it," she cautioned the wind, leaning back hard against it. Just to give you the tone of this book.
That's a very sweet book.
It's wonderful. I read it every year to the preschool that comes to the library.
Oh, good.
Another beautiful winter book for kids is Fox's Dream by Tashima, and it's illustrated by his woodcuts. I don't like them quite as much as Mary Azarian's, but they're really quite marvelous. And speaking of
beautiful,
full moon on the snow, and the fox is walking through the full moon in the forest or dreaming about summer, hopping in the field.
Yeah, see, we're not the only ones who are dreaming of summer in the middle of winter. You have more children's books or no?
Well, what I have, which I want to get to, is another poem, which is a poem that I think there's something about snow and winter and Christmas that you think back to things that you have read long ago. And this is another beautiful story, a poem, which is about an orange. And you know, oranges are very important in the winter, right? They're one of these great fruits you get in the winter. And this has actually appeared in The New Yorker in January 1976. I still have my copy. And it is called Oranges. This morning I eat an orange. It is sour and juicy. My mouth will tingle all day. Outside it is cold. The trees do not anticipate their leaves. When I breathe into my hand, I smell oranges. I walk across the lake. Ice fishermen twitch their poles until perch flicker the surface, quick and bright as orange slices. The sun ripens in the sky. The wind turns thin and citrus, the day precise, fragile. My mustache and eyelashes freeze. When I arrive at your house, you are friendly as a fruit seller. We peel off our clothes, slice through that wordy rind. When I lift my fingers to your lips, oranges. And that is a poem by Ronald Wallace called Oranges.
And you know, oranges, I would say clementines especially, remind me of Christmas, because Christmas morning, my mother always stuck a clementine in our stockings because she thought, I'll get something in them. They can eat
something
because you're not going to go sit at the table to eat breakfast on Christmas morning.
Well, and that was one of the great things about the childhood Christmas tree as well, was that it was covered with things to eat. There were candy canes and there were gingerbread men.
Any more children's books?
Well, I will mention The Snowman by Raymond Briggs. If you have never seen this book, go out today and find a copy. It is actually one of my favorite children's books about snow and snowmen. And there are no words. This is a completely pictures. Only pictures. And it starts with a little boy sleeping, and he wakes up and he sees it snowing, and he runs out and he builds a snowman. And in the best of traditions of fairy tales, the snowman comes to life, and he spends the day with the snowman, who, as it happens, can fly, because this is a picture book, so anything can happen. But it also has a very melancholy ending, because the snowman and the boy become best friends during the course of this book. But of course, in the morning, when he runs out to see the snowman that he has spent the day with, the snowman,
melted.
Of course, has melted. So all you see is the boy looking at the snowman's little coal eyes and his little hat and scarf. So beautifully illustrated, and a great book for any age.
What is that an old book? I was going to say, is that the inspiration for Frosty?
No,
maybe
I don't
the other
believe
way around.
So. I don't believe so. Although there was a film actually made of The Snowman, but completely separate from Frosty the Snowman.
All right.
A different snowman.
And if you've been trying to jot down all these titles, we'll have a link to the list later, Jill, when you get that up and on your website.
We certainly will.
And we'll link it on our website, capeandislands.org. We have like about 20 seconds if we want to mention something else real quick.
I just want to say, if you haven't seen the Great British Bake Off Christmas cookbook, this is the book that you need. But let me warn you, the British, it is the BBC version of this cookbook. And so they are imperial measurements. So be sure that when you look at this book, which is, again, a beautiful book, that you are cognizant of the fact that you are going to need to go to the web or somewhere and make sure you're using
the right measurements,
not the imperial measurements.
All right. Jill Erickson, Jennifer Gaines. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.